Cambridge Certificate of Proficiency in English Listening Test. Test 2. I am going to give you the instructions for this test. I shall introduce each part of the test and give you time to look at the questions. At the start of each piece, you will hear this sound. You will hear each piece twice. Now open your question paper and look at part 1. You will hear 3 different extracts. For questions 1 to 6, choose the answer A, B or C, which fits best according to what you hear. There are 2 questions for each extract. Extract 1.
The received wisdom used to be that there were 4 tastes and that each was perceived at a specific location on the tongue. Sweet tastes at the tip, salty and then sour along the sides, and bitter at the back. This so-called tongue map was based on some rudimentary research originally done in 1901 and then later misinterpreted. But these assumptions went unchallenged for a staggering 73 years until a researcher called Virginia Collings proved that, in fact, every part of the tongue has receptors for every basic taste, including umami, a 5th taste which most Western scientists ignored until relatively recently. Why textbooks should persist in printing this so-called map is quite beyond me, frankly. It certainly baffled me back when I was a kid at school. I could never get the experiment right in science class, and I failed for insisting that I could taste sugar at the back of my mouth. Goes to show you shouldn't always take for granted what your textbook or your teachers tell you. In fact, the remarkable thing about our sense of taste is just how little is known about it. The received wisdom used to be that there were 4 tastes and that each was perceived at a specific location on the tongue. Sweet tastes at the tip, salty and then sour along the sides, and bitter at the back. This so-called tongue map was based on some rudimentary research originally done in 1901 and then later misinterpreted. But these assumptions went unchallenged for a staggering 73 years until a researcher called Virginia Collings proved that, in fact, every part of the tongue has receptors for every basic taste, including umami, a 5th taste which most Western scientists ignored until relatively recently. Why textbooks should persist in printing this so-called map is quite beyond me, frankly. It certainly baffled me back when I was a kid at school. I could never get the experiment right in science class, and I failed for insisting that I could taste sugar at the back of my mouth. Goes to show you shouldn't always take for granted what your textbook or your teachers tell you. In fact, the remarkable thing about our sense of taste is just how little is known about it.
Extract 2.
In some ways, I was fortunate to be born into a family business. When I was 14, I realised I wanted, like my parents, to work in hospitality, but also that I needed to do it in a way that felt right to me. My parents hoped I'd take over the family business as soon as possible, but I enrolled instead at a hotel management school, which led to jobs in Spain, Iran, and Korea. My parents and my bosses made plenty of suggestions. I always just pretended I was listening. But now I am chief executive of the family business. Striking the balance between respect for tradition and innovation is paramount. And I must admit, I've had some real issues with the human resources department. To me, many HR people set too much store by a resume. But a resume doesn't reflect who a person is, especially in the developing world. For our business to succeed, we've got to employ people who can use their initiative. I don't want the HR department to be frightened of people like that. In some ways, I was fortunate to be born into a family business. When I was 14, I realised I wanted, like my parents, to work in hospitality, but also that I needed to do it in a way that felt right to me. My parents hoped I'd take over the family business as soon as possible, but I enrolled instead at a hotel management school, which led to jobs in Spain, Iran, and Korea. My parents and my bosses made plenty of suggestions. I always just pretended I was listening. But now I am chief executive of the family business. Striking the balance between respect for tradition and innovation is paramount. And I must admit, I've had some real issues with the human resources department. To me, many HR people set too much store by a resume, but a resume doesn't reflect who a person is, especially in the developing world. For our business to succeed, we've got to employ people who can use their initiative. I don't want the HR department to be frightened of people like that.
Extract 3.
Hi, Martin. I've just been reading about power and influence as part of my course.
That sounds interesting. I've always thought that well-educated people must be able to exert power over others. Does your reading bear this out?
You might suppose that to be true, but apparently we're all really deferential towards the ones who are introduced to us as though they were some kind of authority. You know, she's head of corporate strategy. It's as though we assume their views are well-founded.
It's like a label which we read as, you can trust me, together with the fact that they're probably earning a fortune. We're like putty in their hands.
I was glad, though, to have it confirmed by research findings that gender no longer plays a part, at least not in most societies. Interestingly, the research also says that people who are seen as a lower social level aren't necessarily more easily influenced. As you'd imagine, it's more to do with self-esteem and our own feelings of worth.
Yes, I can see that.
Hi, Martin. I've just been reading about power and influence as part of my course.
That sounds interesting. I've always thought that well-educated people must be able to exert power over others. Does your reading bear this out?
You might suppose that to be true, but apparently we're all really deferential towards the ones who are introduced to us as though they were some kind of authority. You know, she's head of corporate strategy. It's as though we assume their views are well-founded.
It's like a label which we read as, you can trust me, together with the fact that they're probably earning a fortune. We're like putty in their hands.
I was glad, though, to have it confirmed by research findings that gender no longer plays a part, at least not in most societies. Interestingly, the research also says that people who are seen as a lower social level aren't necessarily more easily influenced. As you'd imagine, it's more to do with self-esteem and our own feelings of worth.
Yes, I can see that.
That is the end of part one. Now turn to part two. You will hear a sport psychologist called Brian Hawthorne giving a talk to psychology students about his profession. For questions 7 to 15, complete the sentences with a word or short phrase. You now have 45 seconds in which to look at part two.
Hello, my name's Brian Hawthorne, and I've been asked to talk to you about my chosen profession, sports psychology. Since it's a relatively new profession, I'd like to give you some information about the activities sports psychologists get involved in, what techniques they employ, and why I think it's a great career. Essentially, sports psychologists treat individual athletes and teams from complete amateurs to top professionals, as well as referees, and all of these across a raft of sporting disciplines. Our main aim is to help clients improve their performance, in particular in competitions. In order to do this, we equip them with the necessary tools, by which I mean appropriate strategies to cope with the injuries and disappointments athletes face during their sporting lives. We may also get involved in advising a coach on things like developing motivation among the players in the squad. As a sports psychologist, you need good communication skills to do this. Some sports psychologists hold full-time positions in professional sports clubs, but mostly they have a varied portfolio, for example, advising individual clients and carrying out academic research. In order to become a sports psychologist, the most likely route is via involvement in sport and a first degree in psychology, followed by accredited postgraduate training. Now, what are the basic techniques that sports psychologists employ? There are a lot of different ones, but underlying each one of them is the aim of instilling mental toughness in competitors, as this is seen as being a crucial factor in putting in a winning performance. Let's have a brief look at a couple of basic strategies to give you an idea of what a sports psychologist does routinely. First, let's take visualization, which means preparing yourself for the challenge ahead by picturing the event in your mind. You see, through visualization, applicants can fill in the blanks about the venue and the procedure, so they'll feel more confident and create what's known as a memory blueprint of how they want to behave. For example, when answering questions which the recruitment panel may ask them. Another technique is known as staying in the present. You may well say that's obvious, that's where we all are. True, but we often have a little voice inside our head that chatters away, dwelling on past mistakes or fretting about the future. And that can interfere with what we're doing right now. For a sportsman, it can be disastrous. For instance, I worked with an international footballer who missed a penalty in the closing moments of an important match. He admitted that instead of focusing on the back of the net, he was fantasising about the admiration he would receive from his ecstatic fellow players when he scored. In other words, what he should have done was focus on the task in hand and not allow himself to get distracted by his own thoughts. It isn't only thoughts, though, that can distract. A sports person has to avoid being sidetracked by spectators' actions. That may be just noise in the stadium, shouting and so on, or what's becoming an increasingly common and disgraceful phenomenon in which spectators bombard a player with insults to put him off his stride. This is just one manifestation of negative public interest. So, what marks out the real top guys? It's that they appear to embrace pressure in a match or a race and actively thrive on it. And for those who don't make it to the top, it may be because they are unable to cope with this. Then once they get to the top, they have to deal with...
Now you will hear part two again.
Hello, my name's Brian Hawthorne, and I've been asked to talk to you about my chosen profession, sports psychology. Since it's a relatively new profession, I'd like to give you some information about the activities sports psychologists get involved in, what techniques they employ, and why I think it's a great career. Essentially, sports psychologists treat individual athletes and teams from complete amateurs to top professionals, as well as referees, and all of these across a raft of sporting disciplines. Our main aim is to help clients improve their performance, in particular in competitions. In order to do this, we equip them with the necessary tools, by which I mean appropriate strategies to cope with the injuries and disappointments athletes face during their sporting lives. We may also get involved in advising a coach on things like developing motivation among the players in the squad. As a sports psychologist, you need good communication skills to do this. Some sports psychologists hold full-time positions in professional sports clubs, but mostly they have a varied portfolio, for example, advising individual clients and carrying out academic research. In order to become a sports psychologist, the most likely route is via involvement in sport and a first degree in psychology, followed by accredited postgraduate training. Now, what are the basic techniques that sports psychologists employ? There are a lot of different ones, but underlying each one of them is the aim of instilling mental toughness in competitors, as this is seen as being a crucial factor in putting in a winning performance. Let's have a brief look at a couple of basic strategies to give you an idea of what a sports psychologist does routinely. First, let's take visualization, which means preparing yourself for the challenge ahead by picturing the event in your mind. You see, through visualization, applicants can fill in the blanks about the venue and the procedure, so they'll feel more confident and create what's known as a memory blueprint of how they want to behave. For example, when answering questions which the recruitment panel may ask them. Another technique is known as staying in the present. You may well say that's obvious, that's where we all are. True, but we often have a little voice inside our head that chatters away, dwelling on past mistakes or fretting about the future, and that can interfere with what we're doing right now. For a sportsman, it can be disastrous. For instance, I worked with an international footballer who missed a penalty in the closing moments of an important match. He admitted that instead of focusing on the back of the net, he was fantasising about the admiration he would receive from his ecstatic fellow players when he scored. In other words, what he should have done was focus on the task in hand and not allow himself to get distracted by his own thoughts. It isn't only thoughts, though, that can distract. A sports person has to avoid being sidetracked by spectators' actions. That may be just noise in the stadium, shouting and so on, or what's becoming an increasingly common and disgraceful phenomenon in which spectators bombard a player with insults to put him off his stride. This is just one manifestation of negative public interest. So, what marks out the real top guys? It's that they appear to embrace pressure in a match or a race and actively thrive on it. And for those who don't make it to the top, it may be because they are unable to cope with this. Then once they get to the top, they have to deal with...
That is the end of part two. Now turn to part three. You will hear a programme in which Rachel and Ian White talk about their office supplies company. For questions 16 to 20, choose the answer A, B, C or D, which fits best according to what you hear. You now have 1 minute in which to look at part three.
Rachel and Ian White started up an office supplies company 8 years ago. It was hard work, but the company's now going from strength to strength. So, Rachel and Ian, what advice would you give to other people thinking of setting up their own business?
Well, one thing that was a bonus for us at first was being able to join the Brisbane Business Network. You know, it's very easy when you're running your own business to get very isolated. And so it was great being able to be around those other business people, and some of them were just fantastic. The way they helped us to be more resourceful in what we were doing.
Like when you're starting a business, I think especially in our situation, we didn't want to think too big too fast or spend too much money. We didn't really know what was feasible.
No. So just meeting the people and networking with them, we saw, hey, these people started out just like us, and look, now they've got their own van or they employ 4 people.
Just being able to talk to them and get tips about the things that they might have stumbled on their way to growth, you know, it's helped us so much and helped us dodge a lot of things that could have gotten in our way.
One thing we learned is it's really important to get your website right and it needs to be professional. So it's worth getting someone who knows about it to design it for you. There are lots of website design companies out there.
But they won't do all the thinking for you. You need to know what you want. We looked at the websites of some of our competitors to see how they did it, And make sure you get one that has a customer support backup. It's really important that if you have any questions, you can get hold of them.
Oh, that's crucial. And it's a good idea to include information about you and who you are as a company. People have more familiarity if they actually understand a little bit more about your business, that you've won some business awards and things like that. So all that stuff needs to be designed in.
But then there's marketing, building up the client base and really understanding what it is that people are looking for in your product or service. What's going to pull them in?
We mostly use email marketing. Now we have a database established from people we've met through our client base and networking. We can send out email campaigns quite efficiently without having to sit all day in the office making phone calls and things like that.
We can just blast out messages from wherever we are. New product offers, updates, and so on. In general, I think fear is a thing that holds a lot of people back, though, and it takes a lot of courage to say, hey, I don't know this, and ask for help.
Like with the sales budget.
Yeah.
We were worried about our budget, so we asked the small businesses company, and they sent someone along, and we had half a day looking at it. And she suggested that we should implement a budget based on our last year's figures and monitor that. And we did. And actually, sales were up, and that in itself was enough to give us the power to say, hey, we're not doing too badly when you see that, regardless of whether you relate it to any other business or not.
We hadn't really had a precise idea of the figures before, and that gave us a tremendous amount of satisfaction.
Yeah, that was quite a good building block for us to establish that.
Mm. So, now your company employs 8 people, and I believe you now present courses on business planning.
Yes, we do. And what it did for me and for Ian was, by going back through those processes again, it was very enlightening for us because there were things that we hadn't actually looked at, specific aspects of the business. And we're finding that they're very valuable to pass on to those students in terms of how you set up a business plan. So, if anything, we found if you were setting up as a new business, yes, business plans were extraordinarily valuable. But as an ongoing business, they're also really good to go back to.
Thank you very much. And if you want to find out more about business planning...
Now you will hear part 3 again.
Rachel and Ian White started up an office supplies company 8 years ago. It was hard work. But the company's now going from strength to strength. So, Rachel and Ian, what advice would you give to other people thinking of setting up their own business?
Well, one thing that was a bonus for us at first was being able to join the Brisbane Business Network. You know, it's very easy when you're running your own business to get very isolated. And so it was great being able to be around those other business people, and some of them were just fantastic. The way they helped us to be more resourceful in what we were doing.
Like, when you're starting a business, I think especially in our situation, we didn't want to think too big too fast or spend too much money. We didn't really know what was feasible.
No. So just meeting the people and networking with them, we saw, hey, these people started out just like us, and look, now they've got their own van or they employ 4 people.
Just being able to talk to them and get tips about the things that they might have stumbled on their way to growth, you know, oh, it's helped us so much and helped us dodge a lot of things that could have gotten in our way.
One thing we learned is it's really important to get your website right and it needs to be professional. So it's worth getting someone who knows about it to design it for you. There are lots of website design companies out there.
But they won't do all the thinking for you. You need to know what you want. We looked at the websites of some of our competitors to see how they did it. And make sure you get one that has a customer support backup. It's really important that if you have any questions, you can get hold of them.
Oh, that's crucial. And it's a good idea to include information about you and who you are as a company. People have more familiarity if they actually understand a little bit more about your business, that you've won some business awards and things like that. So all that stuff needs to be designed in.
But then there's marketing, building up the client base and really understanding what it is that people are looking for in your product or service. What's going to pull them in?
We mostly use email marketing. Now we have a database established from people we've met through our client base and networking. We can send out email campaigns quite efficiently without having to sit all day in the office making phone calls and things like that.
We can just blast out messages from wherever we are. New product offers, updates, and so on. In general, I think fear is a thing that holds a lot of people back, though, and it takes a lot of courage to say, hey, I don't know this, and ask for help.
Like with the sales budget?
Yeah.
We were worried about our budget, so we asked the small businesses company, and they sent someone along, and we had half a day looking at it. And she suggested that we should implement a budget based on our last year's figures and monitor that. And we did. And actually, sales were up, and that in itself was enough to give us the power to say, hey, we're not doing too badly when you see that, regardless of whether you relate it to any other business or not.
We hadn't really had a precise idea of the figures before, and that gave us a tremendous amount of satisfaction.
Yeah, that was quite a good building block for us to establish that.
Mm. So, now your company employs 8 people, and I believe you now present courses on business planning.
Yes, we do. And what it did for me and for Ian was, by going back through those processes again, it was very enlightening for us because there were things that we hadn't actually looked at, specific aspects of the business. And we're finding that they're very valuable to pass on to those students in terms of how you set up a business plan. So, if anything, we found if you were setting up as a new business, yes, business plans were extraordinarily valuable. But as an ongoing business, they're also really good to go back to.
Thank you very much. And if you want to find out more about business planning...
That is the end of part 3. Now turn to part 4. Part 4 consists of 2 tasks. You will hear 5 short extracts, in which university students are talking about a work placement that they did. Look at task 1. For questions 21 to 25, choose from the list A to H how each speaker found their work placement. Now look at task 2. For questions 26 to 30, choose from the list A to H what each speaker found most useful during the work placement. While you listen, you must complete both tasks. You now have 45 seconds in which to look at part 4. Speaker 1.
It wasn't easy getting a work placement. I spent ages surfing the net, researching law firms, filling in application forms, asking other law students for advice on places to try. Some firms seemed interested and then went quiet. Then it struck me a former neighbour was a solicitor in a small practice, which wasn't ideal really, but still. After some persuasion, I was offered an informal week's tryout, which was extended. It was hard getting up at 6:15 every day and working till 5:30. What made it, though, was being allowed to take over some tasks like drafting simple contracts. If I got stuck, the other staff kindly showed me what to do.
Speaker 2.
I did a work placement in a finance company. I'd heard that the best part is learning to complete work to deadlines, though I'd got that sorted handing in uni assignments. What I did every day involved using ideas I'd heard in lectures and seeing them work. That was mind-blowing and more valuable than all the stuff I had to look up for clients in the resource centre. I was very lucky, as I came across someone at a friend's wedding who got me an interview at the company. It was a relief, as I thought I'd have to ask my uncle, who's in banking, and I'd rather make my own way.
Speaker 3.
I started looking for a work placement early on. I sent letters to companies I was interested in and got some positive responses. I chose one and thought it was all in hand till everything fell through. I was moaning about it to someone on my marketing course who put me onto a car manufacturer, not my field, so I had reservations, though needlessly, as it turned out. They put me in the sales department initially, My line manager had regular sessions with me to give me pointers on how well I'd been doing, and that will definitely stand me in good stead. Chatting to people during breaks was quite informative too.
Speaker 4.
I worked in an advertising agency. It was great, though the market analysis I did was tedious. I attended meetings where senior staff presented ideas for publicising a product. Discussing those with people from the company concerned made the whole thing, really, as it showed me what avenue to follow. It would have been good to have run a project on my own, though. I got the placement in an unexpected way. I thought everything happened online, though my searches proved fruitless. I came across the agency in an advert in a marketing publication which I replied to. The university department's so-called directory of work placements left a lot to be desired.
Speaker 5.
I'm studying to be an accountant like my cousin, and he'd promised me a placement at his firm. He's a great guy, though up to his eyes with work, and it obviously slipped his mind. A lecturer showed me our department's database on the university server, and that did the trick. I really enjoyed the placement. The staff had very different working methods, which was an eye-opener. It was demanding getting everything I'd been given done in time, though that's certainly what my work will involve. Sitting at a desk for 8 hours without even getting to see any of the people whose accounts I was doing was debatable, though.
Now you will hear part 4 again. Speaker 1.
It wasn't easy getting a work placement. I spent ages surfing the net, researching law firms, filling in application forms, asking other law students for advice on places to try. Some firms seemed interested and then went quiet. Then it struck me a former neighbour was a solicitor in a small practice, which wasn't ideal really, but still. After some persuasion, I was offered an informal week's tryout, which was extended. It was hard getting up at 6:15 every day and working till 5:30. What made it, though, was being allowed to take over some tasks like drafting simple contracts. If I got stuck, the other staff kindly showed me what to do.
Speaker 2.
I did a work placement in a finance company. I'd heard that the best part is learning to complete work to deadlines, though I'd got that sorted handing in uni assignments. What I did every day involved using ideas I'd heard in lectures and seeing them work. That was mind-blowing and more valuable than all the stuff I had to look up for clients in the resource centre. I was very lucky, as I came across someone at a friend's wedding who got me an interview at the company. It was a relief, as I thought I'd have to ask my uncle, who's in banking, and I'd rather make my own way.
Speaker 3.
I started looking for a work placement early on. I sent letters to companies I was interested in and got some positive responses. I chose one and thought it was all in hand till everything fell through. I was moaning about it to someone on my marketing course who put me onto a car manufacturer, not my field, so I had reservations, though needlessly, as it turned out. They put me in the sales department initially. My line manager had regular sessions with me to give me pointers on how well I'd been doing, and that will definitely stand me in good stead. Chatting to people during breaks was quite informative too.
Speaker 4.
I worked in an advertising agency. It was great, though the market analysis I did was tedious. I attended meetings where senior staff presented ideas for publicising a product. Discussing those with people from the company concerned made the whole thing, really, as it showed me what avenue to follow. It would have been good to have run a project on my own, though. I got the placement in an unexpected way. I thought everything happened online, though my searches proved fruitless. I came across the agency in an advert in a marketing publication which I replied to. The university department's so-called directory of work placements left a lot to be desired.
Speaker 5.
I'm studying to be an accountant like my cousin, and he'd promised me a placement at his firm. He's a great guy, though up to his eyes with work, and it obviously slipped his mind. A lecturer showed me our department's database on the university server, and that did the trick. I really enjoyed the placement. The staff had very different working methods, which was an eye-opener. It was demanding getting everything I'd been given done in time, though that's certainly what my work will involve. Sitting at a desk for 8 hours without even getting to see any of the people whose accounts I was doing was debatable, though.
That is the end of part four. That is the end of the test. Please stop now.